This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we talk about the disturbing case of Marcus Smith, who police hogtied and killed.
Not only are they trying to cover the case up, but they're going after the messenger, just like they did in the Julian Assange case or even the Guantanamo cases.
Over the last several decades, entities called think tanks have exercised an influential role in defining the policies we live in.
This is important stuff because we can learn how the ruling class in this country rules. Phyllis Bennis joins us to talk more about how this is done.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
Police in America kill over 1,500 citizens a year. That's over three a day. Disproportionately black. Police killed over 1,500 people the year before the murder of George Floyd, and in the year since his murder, they've killed another 1,500. The latest outrageous case has come to the National Four in Greensboro, North Carolina, where eight white cops killed Marcus Smith 2 years ago by hogtying him, causing him to suffocate to death. Now they're being sued, and they're trying to cover it up and trying to silence the Smith family's attorney, Flint Taylor, drive him out of the state, and sanction him with heavy financial penalties. So instead of banning hogtying, paying reparations, settling the case with the Smith family, and issuing an apology, they're trying to silence the messenger. Hogtying can be lethal. It's done by handcuffing the victim behind his back, shackling his feet, and then tying the handcuffs to the feet, bending him over backwards, chest first, in the street. Marcus Smith died of asphyxiation within a minute. On September 8, 2018, Marcus Smith was suffering from a mental health crisis. He was brutally hogtied by the Greensboro, North Carolina police. The family's civil rights case is being litigated by Chicago People's Law Office attorneys Flint Taylor and Ben Elson and the Greensboro lawyer Graham Holt. It's worthy of national attention. The cops' lawyers have been paid more than $1 million of taxpayers' money to date to defend the case. They have escalated their attacks on the Smith family, and they're seeking to suppress all the damaging evidence that has come to light during the pretrial discovery process. We speak today with attorney Flint Taylor of the People's Law Office. Taylor is a nationally recognized civil rights attorney. He represented the family of Fred Hampton, demonstrating that the Chicago Police Department and the FBI were responsible for the assassination of the young Black Panther leader. He's written the book The Killing Machine, Racism and Police Violence in Chicago. He's one of the editors of the Police Misconduct Law Reporter.
Flint Taylor, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Heidi and Mike. It's great to be back.
Flint, tell us what happened to 38-year-old Marcus Smith on September 8, 2018, when he was at a folk music concert in Greensboro, North Carolina, and asked a police officer to take him to the hospital.
Well, Heidi, I first should premise what I'm saying with the fact that we're under attack in Greensboro for talking about the Marcus Smith case. And when I say we're under attack in our civil lawsuit by the lawyers who are being representing the city of Greensboro. So in a way, there's a real chilling effect on the lawyers and the movement down there. But I feel that it's important to talk about the Marcus Smith case because the Marcus Smith case is a case that really reflects racist attitudes in the police departments across the country and the fact that black men and black women are being killed unnecessarily at the hands of white police officers, not only in Greensboro, but across the country. But to address your question, yes, 2.5 years ago on a street in downtown Greensboro, Marcus Smith was hogtied. And by hogtied, it is what it sounds like. It's binding the hands to the feet while a person is prone in a hogtied position. And it puts a tremendous amount of pressure on the respiratory and cardiac systems. They managed Marcus struggled because he was gradually losing his life. but they ultimately hogtied him, and he almost instantly stopped breathing, lost his pulse, and he was pronounced dead at the hospital. There were 8 white Greensboro police officers who did this. He was in the throes of a mental health crisis. He had ingested some drugs, and he was pleading to go to the hospital. And they told him that they would take him to the hospital, but instead they put him in the back of a police car and took their sweet time about taking him. And before they did take him, he started to act out as someone in a mental crisis would when they're cooped up in the back seat of a police car under the promise that they're going to the hospital to get some relief from the demons that he understood he was suffering from. And so he started to thrash around, and there was a threat that he might damage their precious police car. So they opened up the door, took him to the ground, and hogtied him. And that was their solution, rather than getting him the mental health care that he needed. And since that time, Heidi and Mike, there's been a tremendous movement on the ground down there, and it's justice for Marcus Smith, and it's been having all sorts of different protests and activist actions. We're proud as public interest lawyers to be litigating a public interest lawsuit on behalf of Mary Smith, the proud and courageous mother of Marcus Smith, and George Smith, his father. The representation with regard to the city are private lawyers who have been paid upwards of $1 million already to defend this case. And that's where we're at. We're at a situation where they're trying to silence us with an order to show cause in court. They're trying to seal documents that are public documents. And we're having a situation that raises the question about the First Amendment rights of public interest lawyers and the rights of the movement to cooperate with lawyers and to fight for justice. And justice in this case, and justice in view of a public interest lawsuit, is not restricted to, you know, dollars and cents. As you know, Section 1983 deals with deterrence. It deals with stopping unconstitutional conduct. And in this instance, it deals with reparations, that there should not only be damages for Marcus Smith's family, but there should be an apology. There should be an admission of wrongdoing. And there should also be a memorial, among other things, and changes in training and that kind of thing. So all of that, and, you know, we feel, and the movement feels, that this case should be looked at like the George Floyd case. It's an unnecessary restraint of a black man in the street and a cover-up that followed. And, of course, in Greensboro, which likes to put itself forward as some kind of new South, what we have here is nothing but really the Democratic version of Trumpism. I mean, while across the South and other parts of the country they're trying to restrict voting laws, in Greensboro, the Democrats are trying to keep a lid on police misconduct in general, and the fatal death of Marcus Smith in particular.
The body cam video of what was done to Marcus Smith wasn't released for a month or so in what can only be called a cover-up. Now, as you've referred to, we understand the attorneys for the city of Greensboro and the police there have made a motion to get a court order to silence you, to keep you from talking about the case. They even mentioned one of the Law and Disorder radio interviews you did. Can you make an analogy with trying to silence the attorneys who had clients who were tortured in Guantanamo Bay prison, or even Julian Assange?
First off, it would the cover-up with regard to the video and the truth of what happened to Marcus Smith was for several months. And it was only when the family of Marcus Smith, the father, and their lawyer at that time viewed the video, did they learn that he was hogtied. In the same way that the initial press release up in Minneapolis didn't mention that George Floyd had been restrained with a knee to his neck. The press release in Greensboro, and they issued two of them, one 2 days after the other, in both, neither of them did they mention there was any form of restraint of Marcus Smith. They made it sound like this black man who was having a mental health crisis collapsed in police custody. And that was the big lie that they told, and then they attempted to keep the video secret, but of course the family saw it and raised questions courageously. They still tried to keep the video secret until a medical examiner found that the lead cause of death was prone restraint, and that the manner of death was not an accident, not collapsing, but homicide. So when that happened, then phase two of the cover-up unfolded, and here we are in court with I don't know what phase of the cover-up that we're dealing with now. But to directly answer your question, of course, I think there's analogies in terms of because they're sweeping not only the lawyers here, but they're sweeping two of the foremost community activists down there into their net of order to show cause, and that's Lewis Pitts, a very famous former civil rights lawyer who I fought with side by side in the case against the Klan, of course, which was in Greensboro and implicated the Greensboro police back in the 1980s. And they're not only sweeping them into this, but they're sweeping the one independent journalist who's written the most articles about the case. They're attacking him as well, and they're claiming that we gave these folks that what turns out to be non-confidential information. So in that sense, in the Assange case, you know, they're going after someone who may have been a source, but they're implicating the whole idea of freedom of the press and the freedom of independent investigative journalists and other folks to bring the truth, particularly in situations like Assange was doing with WikiLeaks back during the Iraq War. And in Guantanamo, the situation was that they were gagging lawyers from talking about or even knowing about information that was already public because WikiLeaks and others had revealed it, and because it was supposedly national security. We don't even have those kinds of situations in Greensboro. It's just that they do not like what we're saying and what the journalists are writing about, and the fact that Marcus Smith is now not some kind of quiet secret on the streets of Greensboro where they protest every week, but it's now coming into national focus. It's now coming into state focus, that the coalitions are joining with coalitions with Elizabeth City and the Brown case. They're joining with mothers across the country who are demanding justice for their children who have been murdered and killed by police officers. And they're shining a light on hog tying. The most recent Marshall Project article investigated how often hog tying is being used still in this country and where it is and where it isn't. And of course it's very embarrassing to Greensboro that they continue to hog tie people 25 years after the New York City Police Department banned it. And this kind of coming to public, national and local light in the wake of George Floyd, and in the no mistake that they filed this motion after the George Floyd conviction of Chauvin. One council person down there has broken ranks, and there's no coincidence that they're doing all of this as the case is gaining more traction, and the case is coming into national light, and that there is a crack in their code of silence that goes all the way to the mayor, goes all the way to the city manager, the chief of police, the former chief of police. All of these folks have been deposed, and they don't want their own words their non-confidential words to go outside of the litigation. And that's really what it's all about. It's kind of a more genteel form of what we're seeing across the South and other places in terms of suppression of voter rights. In this instance, it's a suppression of the right to speak and the right to bring the truth about police violence and racism to the fore.
Attorney Flint Taylor, what's your theory of liability in this case, and how are the defendants defending the case?
Well, our theory of liability is that it was excessive use of force under the Fourth Amendment to hogtie Marcus Smith in the manner that they did, violently pushing his legs to almost touching his handcuffs behind his back while he was moaning and groaning and wheezing and pleading, knowing that he was in a prone position that was known to be a danger to people who are being restrained. And our theory with regard to the city of Greensboro is that they not only countenance this kind of hogtying, but they routinely did it, particularly against black men, and that their training allowed them to what they call maximally restrain people in this manner. And so therefore the city's squarely on the hook for what happened to Marcus Smith. And the city's defending it by lining up one right after the other, saying what they did was okay and that their training was sufficient. Underlying all of this is the question of qualified immunity. They raised it on a motion to dismiss and lost. They're rattling their sabers about how they're going to win on a motion for summary judgment on the question of qualified immunity. And again, not only do we totally feel that's wrong, but how tone deaf is it in this day and age where qualified immunity is rightfully coming under tremendous scrutiny, both nationally and locally. Some jurisdictions, some states are banning qualified immunity. The George Floyd Act in Congress seeks to ban qualified immunity. And here they are dancing around, pounding their chests that, gee, they might just get off with qualified immunity. Shame on them.
Flint, what happened to Marcus Smith's father when he viewed the videotape?
Marcus Smith's father had the courage to watch the video about a month later. As I mentioned, at that point, the family didn't know how he died. They certainly didn't believe that he just collapsed and that he was suicidal and that that was the beginning and end of it. So they came up from South Carolina to watch the video. Marcus's mother couldn't watch her son die. But George did watch it with Graham Holt, a very courageous young lawyer down in Greensboro who represented the family at that time and continues to co-counsel with us in the civil case. And what he was so shocked and upset when he saw that what happened to his son, that he's had health issues ever since. When I appeared at a press conference recently in Greensboro, which they ran into court instantly after I appeared and supplemented their motion to hold us in contempt because I had the temerity to speak to a community group of 13 ministers and the press along with Mary Smith. George was there, and he was certainly not 100%, but he was starting to recover from what the kind of emotional setback that he had. He had to stop working because of the trauma that he felt back in October 2018, when he saw what happened to his son and how they'd lied to him. And you know, they still haven't apologized to him or to the mother. And they continue this misinformation campaign. And as public interest lawyers, we have an obligation to defend our clients and defend it, our clients when they're wrongfully accused in the press, when the case is misrepresented, when it's covered up. I think that if you're a public interest lawyer, if you're fighting for constitutional rights in important cases, you are not adequately or zealously representing your client if you don't speak out, if you don't straighten the record, if you don't attempt to bring the truth of non-confidential evidence to the fore. And so that's what we have been doing, and that's what we will continue to do, unless they're able to gag us. And, you know, they filed two motions. And one motion was to seal an 11-page letter that we wrote laying out the evidence that supported the fact that we had the right to speak. They moved to put that under seal. So that we termed that motion the motion to suppress and conceal and make this a Star Chamber proceeding. And then the order to show cause why we shouldn't be held in contempt, which it suggests that we not be able to practice in North Carolina. And, in fact, that's like trying to run us out of the state. But we're not voluntarily leaving. But that's the motion to gag and chill. I mean, let's call these motions what they really are. And we're fighting them, and this very day we'll be filing a response that'll not only talk about the law, but will document through about 300 pages of exhibits the true nature of the battle for the truth, for the public conscience in Greensboro and across the country with regard to Marcus Smith and hog tying.
Attorney Flint Taylor, we're running out of our allotted time here, but we wanted to ask you about the community support that the Smith family is getting, and what's the next step in litigation?
Well, it's marvelous how the community, the black preachers, the white activists, the young people, the older people, all have come together from the moment that they knew what happened to Marcus Smith, and the video was, they were compelled to release the video after the finding of homicide became known, right to the present. I mean, yesterday there was a demonstration. There are going to be two demonstrations across June in connection with Reverend Barber and the Elizabeth City, North Carolina police killing case. Mrs. Smith is now part of the mothers across the country who are demanding justice for the deaths and killings and murders of their children. So the movement's been wonderful, and that's why they're trying to shut it down. That's why they're trying to shut down independent journalism. So the next move beyond defending ourselves and defending the movement in court is to finish discovery. We have a wonderful expert, police practices expert, who is working with the George Floyd case to develop new procedures in Minneapolis, and they're going to depose him. Then if there's not any serious negotiations around reparations, and I use the term reparations because the community and we are demanding not only damages, but also an apology and also a memorial, among other things, then we'll go to summary judgment, and we'll see whether their callous use of qualified immunity will win the day for them. But it's all making them money. It's all $300 an hour for these lawyers, which they took great offense at us calling them silk stocking lawyers. But be that as it may, they're working on their second million of taxpayers' money down there to defend what we consider to be the indefensible.
Flint, once again, you are an inspiration for those of us who care about justice, and we will be following you and hope to talk with you again about efforts to silence you and the other attorneys who want to bring this case to the public fore.
Well, thank you, Heidi, and I'm glad that you're not chilled. Law and Disorder made it into their motion, they'll probably run in with this interview as well. But you all have been bringing these issues to public light now for decades. And I know it's in the greatest tradition of you and Michael, and of course Michael Ratner, that public interest lawyers continue to fight these cases and continue to bring the truth to light. Otherwise, we really will have no chance at any kind of meaningful participatory people's democracy.
How can people follow the case and the work of the People's Law Office?
Well, I think they should keep an eye on Greensboro, North Carolina. This, as I said, this case is coming to public light despite the frantic and desperate issue attempts at the lawyers and the power structure down there to keep it quiet. And of course, the People's Law Office can be followed at peopleslawoffice.com. And also, I have a book called The Torture Machine that talks about police torture in Chicago. And my partner, Jeff Haas, has a book that talks about the assassination of Fred Hampton. So those are ways that you can learn about the office and some of the important work that we all have been doing now for the last 51 years.
Flint, thanks for being on Law and Disorder, and have a wonderful day.
Thank you. We'll spend the day finishing our answer to their motion to gag and chill.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Globalization on the heels of the Cold War, entities called think tanks grew rapidly during the late 1980s. Today, there are nearly 2,000 think tanks in the United States alone, and not surprisingly, more than 400 are located in the nation's capital, where they have ready access to key policymakers. These entities play an outsized role in shaping the world we live in. From national defense and technology to social policy and economics, think tanks perform in-depth research on a range of topics. Some advocate for change by using this research and their analytical reports to influence public opinion and guide decision makers in creating policy agendas. It follows that many think tanks align along party lines. Funding for think tanks usually comes from endowments, government contracts, private donations, and sales of their reports. While many think tanks are nonprofit organizations, some especially high-profile ideological ones advocate solutions that benefit their corporate donors. Often, these are criticized for crossing the line between research and lobbying. Think tanks are classified according to their sources of funding and their intended customers. Some, like the Rand Corporation, receive direct government assistance, but most others are funded by private individuals or corporate donors. To help demystify think tanks and their role in society, we're joined today by Phyllis Bennis, who works at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C. Phyllis, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Great to be with you, Heidi.
Phyllis, the Institute for Policy Studies, where you work, describes itself as the first multi-issue progressive think tank. Tell us a bit about IPS, its mission, and if applicable, its ideological bent.
You know, it's sort of an amazing history, Heidi. IPS was founded back in 1963 by two people, Marcus Raskin and Richard Barnett, who both were working for the Kennedy administration. Dick was at the State Department and Mark at the White House. And both of them separately, and then they sort of met each other and realized they were both thinking the same thing, were increasingly disillusioned with the policy approaches of the Kennedy administration, particularly regarding nuclear weapons, the rising threat of major war, which had not quite broken out yet in Vietnam, and the Cuban Missile Crisis, and the whole relationship with Cuba. So all of those things together fairly quickly led them to leave the administration and go out into the world, still determined to impact U.S. policy, make it better, make it more progressive, from outside. And they created something that didn't really exist before, which was a progressive slash left independent think tank, not tied to a university, not tied to the government, stating very explicitly from its origins that we won't take government money. It's never really taken corporate money, except once I think we got a grant from Ben and Jerry's at one point. So maybe we can't really say that. But basically, that we were going to be independent. And from that day on, IPS has been this incredible center. And the idea was it was going to work with the social movements that were rising then and have been rising ever since. So early on, the IPS had a lot of ties and a lot of connections with the civil rights movement, with the emerging anti-war movement, later with the women's and environmental justice movements, certainly in the 90s, the anti-corporate globalization movements, and anti-war movements, particularly strong when, and you know, what I've been most involved with, beginning in certainly in the 90s around Iraq and sanctions, but also as soon as the 9/11 attacks made clear that the response to those crimes was going to be to take the world to war, IPS jumped into the anti-war mobilization, both domestic and global, full throttle, and have, you know, we've been pretty involved in it ever since. And now we work very closely, for example, with the Poor People's Campaign, which has a four-part commitment to what it's going to take to transform the lives of the 140 million poor and low-wealth people in this country, that it's going to take fighting against poverty, against systemic racism, against climate catastrophe, and against militarism. And we do that with social movements that are on the rise around the country, whether it's Black Lives Matter, whether it's the massive number of young activists taking up the global justice and environmental justice work, the work around immigrant rights. So the link between creating ideas and linking those ideas with social movements has been from the beginning the theory of change, if you will, of how IPS operates. We don't think that the way you make change is to come up with a brilliant idea and make sure you get it on the desk of the most powerful person you can reach in Washington. We think that we do the best chance of changing the world by linking with movements where if we come up with good ideas and do important research about how those ideas can be realized, and getting that information into the hands of activists and leaders of these social movements, that's how we change the world.
So, Phyllis, are you saying that at IPS you use both a research component coupled with discussions and partnerships with more grassroots organizations to see what's worked for them and get their input?
Absolutely. And when we come up with stuff, whether it's reports or op-eds or whatever, we immediately work to get that information back out to those grassroots organizations that we work with all the time to make sure they can use it for their members. They do internal education. They use it as a guide for advocacy work in Congress. I will say that we do some what we call inside work as well. You know, we have a sort of inside-outside strategy where the bulk of our work is with movements that are outside of the hallways of power. We do a little bit of work with Congress when we can get access. We work closely with the Progressive Caucus, for instance, and at times with the Congressional Black Caucus. But our overall sense of how you really change the world is that Congress can play an important role at times when there are movements that are rising and that are mobilized to put pressure on Congress. So it's really the outside part that we spend most of our time and energy.
Phyllis, I'd like to ask you about the Heritage Foundation. It came to prominence during the Reagan administration, and Reagan credited their study, Mandate for Leadership, as an inspiration for many of his policies. What impact has it had, if any, on government spending and federal budget issues?
Well, unfortunately, it's had a lot of influence on a lot of things, budgets being one of the most dangerous parts. You know, one of the ironies of the Heritage Foundation, when they were created in the 80s, they built their organizational structure essentially based on the model that they saw of what we were doing at IPS. I shouldn't say we, I wasn't there at the time, but what IPS was doing. They saw that as the model of how you influence the world, how you change the world. And they went ahead and tried to do that from a very conservative, far-right approach based on the idea of small government, lower taxes, no spending, pull people up by their bootstraps on their own if they can, and if they can't, it's their own problem. Don't deal with issues around racism and class disparities and inequality. You know, it's a very right-wing agenda, but there's this irony that their structure at the time they were created was sort of, they were looking at IPS as this opposite model from what they were going to do. And of course, they were able to do it. IPS has been funded without government money, without corporate largesse, if you will. And they thought, well, if those people can do it with, you know, on sort of a pittance, what could we do with all of our rich friends and all of our corporate friends? And that's where they got their money. And of course, like a lot of the conservative and centrist think tanks, whether it's Brookings or CAP or Heritage, any of these, they also serve as kind of a farm team for whichever, whether it's the Democrats or the Republicans, that are closer to their ideological bent. So when Reagan was in power, a lot of people came right from the Heritage Foundation into that administration. When the Republicans lost the White House, they don't have access to the State Department, they don't have access to the Treasury Department, etc. Then you see those people trotting back over to work in the think tank world again, and as soon as their policy people, their political allies are back in power, they go trotting over across the street to rejoin the White House or the State Department or whatever it is, you know. So there's this sort of revolving door role of conservative and centrist and even liberalish think tanks with government positions.
Phyllis, Rohinton Medoro, who's president of the Center for International Governance Innovation, has said that the purpose of think tanks is, quote, influence peddling in the best sense of the term. The litmus test of a good think tank, he suggests, isn't whether it's right, left, liberal or not, but whether it was proposing evidence-based discussion. Can you talk about what you've just noted, that revolving door paradigm that we actually see so often in government and the corporate world? Does that alter the notion of providing purely evidence-based discussion.
Absolutely. I mean, if you look at the military side, for instance, something like CSIS, the Center for Strategic and International Studies, you have somebody like Anthony Cordesman, who's the dean of military analysts, right? And during the Iraq War, he was a great proponent of war. He was a critic of how the U.S. was waging its war, but he was a great supporter of the legitimacy of war, you know, and it's he had access at various points during the Bush period, et cetera. He had access to the White House. You would see him on television. You would see him on the Lehr News Hour. You would see him, you know, here and there. He would issue a new report. It would be written up on the front page of the Washington Post and the New York Times. And you see an enormous level of influence. And at the same time, you see this possibility that maybe not Cordesman himself, but people he has trained at CSIS and elsewhere, as soon as there's a shift, the Republicans come back into power, suddenly a bunch of those people are suddenly on the short list for various policy positions in the State Department and in the Pentagon and maybe at the National Security Council. And then when their preferred party is out of power, then they leave and they go back to CSIS for a while. So this theory that the way you change the world is to hold up these ideas and get them into the hands of the powerful, it certainly does have it certainly does have sway, and it does have influence on how those policies take shape. What it doesn't take into account is the need for wholesale change in this country. You know, the need for transformational change, the need for systemic change. And that's where you need, in our view, that's where you need social movements to make that change. They're not going to come from Congress. They're not going to come from the White House. Members of Congress are not going to lead on how to transform state violence and police brutality in this country, how to transform systemic racism. Eventually, members of Congress will follow the lead of movements, whether it's the Movement for Black Lives, whether it's the Poor People's Campaign, whatever it is, but they're not going to take the lead. And I think that the view of these other think tanks is that that's who leads. You know, people in power are the ones who lead. They're in power because they're smart, and we're going to help them be smarter. You know, it's some version of that. And it's a very limiting approach, I would say, because it assumes that the systemic realities are fine and that all we need to do is sort of tinker around the edges. And when you look at the impact of those broad realities on the vast majority of people in this country, most especially people of color, you see that it doesn't work and it's not going to be stable in the long term. And if you don't engage with the movements that represent and come out of those communities that are disproportionately impacted, you're going to be in serious trouble.
Phyllis, the D.C.-based Center for Strategic and International Studies was founded at the Center for Strategic and International Studies of Georgetown University in 1962. Tell us about their work, which they describe as, quote, defining the future of national security.
Yeah, they're probably the most influential. They and the RAND Corporation, I would say, are the two think tanks that are the most influential in both parties, I would say, in how to wage war, how to maintain U.S. military power. It's grounded in an unchallenged acceptance of the notion that the U.S. being a military superpower, spending what is now 53 cents of every federal dollar on the military, while we spend only 15 cents on poverty alleviation, for instance, is fine. And that we're the ones who can come up with the most creative ways to use that power. It doesn't take into account that power and influence in the world may not be best created by military threats and by being the champion of military arms sales, of military aid around the world, even while we have among the lowest levels of foreign aid as a proportion of GDP of any of the wealthiest countries around the world. So there's no, again, there's no challenging to the existing frameworks of where power is. And CSIS, I mean, obviously there's different people there who have different approaches to things, but essentially as an, on an institutional basis, their work reflects this view that U.S. military power should be strengthened, should be burnished, and should be available at a moment's notice for any president, for any purpose, and the notion of privileging diplomacy rather than military force is simply not on their agenda. Simply not on their agenda. So they're all about improving how the U.S. goes to war, how we prepare for war, how we define where our next war will be fought. So these various strategies that come out of the Pentagon often reflect discussions with so-called experts from CSIS, or who then go to CSIS and spend a couple of years there and go back to the Pentagon. Things like the idea that the U.S. should be prepared to fight two major wars with peer-level military challengers, maybe one war with Russia and another war with China, and a smaller war against terrorism somewhere else. These wars that then, in the planning, lead to the notion that somehow it's okay to spend $750 billion just this year on military spending, that that's somehow okay. That's what we're seeing when we look at a place like CSIS.
And Phyllis, what are we seeing when we look at the Cato Institute?
You know, Cato is interesting because it's a little bit different. Because Cato is supported by the Koch brothers foundations. It's very much on the isolationist side. And on the issues around taxation, international law, they are as reactionary as could be. They hate the UN, you know, but if you look at their policies on U.S. wars, they actually have very cogent arguments, and they play a role in lobbying Congress and other things against, for example, the involvement of the U.S. militarily in backing the Saudi-led coalition in Yemen. So it's an odd combination. It can lead on occasion and on a very tactical level to a strange bedfellow scenario where you have these very conservative isolationists who, for reasons that we would really disagree with, come to the same conclusion that we might have in terms of the urgency of ending U.S. support for Saudi bombing and destruction of Yemen. So they're a kind of a different, in a different political position. I would say what they share with CSIS, and what they share, frankly, with Brookings and CAP and others, is the view that the way you change the world, the way you get your positions out there, is essentially solely an inside job, that you try to get to members of Congress and the White House and get it to the National Security Council, and that's your focus. So in that way, they're much more similar. They're not big on building movements, I would say.
Phyllis Bennis, are there any progressive or vaguely progressive think tanks like the Urban Institute in D.C. or the Center for American Progress or the Guttmacher Institute?
I think there are a number of progressive think tanks. The EPI, the Economic Policy Institute, Urban Institute, as you say, are very much on the progressive side. I think the difference is IPS is the only multi-issue one. We work on issues, as we like to put it, of peace, justice, and the environment, and turning ideas into action on those issues. On the other side, I mean, CAP, for instance, is very much part of the centrist wing of the Democratic Party, and it's very much a farm team for staffing up the White House, the State Department, et cetera, when there are Democrats in office. I think that the Urban Institute is very focused on issues of racial justice. I think that EPI similarly has a one-part focus on the economy. But we work with them a lot. You know, we're allies. I think one thing that's been very important is the Progressive Caucus of Congress has created the Progressive Caucus Center, which is a separate non-governmental organization. And one of the things it does is pull together folks from a variety of progressive think tanks to help the Progressive Caucus come up with good ideas for what they can be supporting, which mainly reflects what movements are already working on. So that's been an important step forward, I think, both for the Progressive Caucus, but also for those of us who work in progressive think tanks to be working together a bit more. So that's been an optimistic notion.
Phyllis, we're coming, unfortunately, to the end of our allotted time. Remind our listeners how they can learn more about the Institute for Policy Studies and your work in particular.
Our website is ips-dc.org. And when you're on the website, if you look either under experts, you can look for my name, Phyllis Bennis, or if you look under projects, the New Internationalism Project, which I run along with my colleague Corrie Peterson-Smith, who is the Michael Ratner Middle East Fellow at IPS, and together we do a lot of work on Palestinian rights, on ending wars and occupations, ending the militarization of borders, all those kinds of issues.
Phyllis Bennis, it's always a pleasure to talk with you. We hope to stay in touch, especially about issues happening internationally, and want to thank you once again.
Thank you both. It's been a pleasure.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.